Let me say a word of welcome to everybody. My name is Murray Levin, and I'm actually wearing two hats here. One is as a partner with the Pepper office, and on behalf of the office and my partners and colleagues, I'm pleased to invite you and welcome you. And as a board member of the Middle East Foundation, I just want to make sure that everybody here knows a little bit about the work of the foundation. For those of you who are not members, I hope you'll consider joining. You can join outside, and I'm going to direct you to the website, which is ME Forum, Middle East Forum, meforum.org, and you'll find out all about the many activities, which include, of course, researching and writing and publishing, and public education, exactly as we are doing today. I want to take a second and ask everybody to turn off cell phones and PDAs and whatever else might be buzzing in your pocket or pocketbook. Take a second and please do that. And I want to emphasize the work that our director, our president, Dan Pipes, who's so well known to many of you, does. Of course, trying to define and promote American interests in the Middle East. Dan was one of the very earliest to look to and decry the threat posed by radical Islam. The Middle East Forum has been in the lead trying to strategize on methods of containing the nuclear ambitions of Iran. More of that today from our speaker, I think. The Middle East Forum is very wrapped up in efforts to encourage democracy in the Middle East. But I think most of you know that, and those of you who do not, I'm going to really hope that you'll take a minute and look at some of the materials on the table outside and go to the website. Now, in a very real sense, our guest today really doesn't need any introduction. He's very well known to all of us from probably a quarter of a century or so with the Philadelphia Inquirer, a post that he has recently returned to as a featured columnist. His work appears in national publications. He's written for the New York Times, the New Yorker, I think Sports Illustrated, if memory serves me. And he's well known because of the books that he's written, some of which you may have seen in the movies. Perhaps the most well-known is Black Hawk Down, which won the National Book Award, and equally engrossing and well-known is Killing Pablo. Now, we're really privileged that today our featured guest will be speaking to us a little bit about a book which you may wish to purchase there, which is Guests of the Ayatollah, The First Battle in America's War with Militant Islam. We are now living in an era when the president, whose name I'll try to say, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, is in the press quite a bit, threatening to wipe Israel off the map, pushing a nuclear weapons ambition, and in general making himself very unpalatable to interests that we in this country, and we specifically in the Middle East Forum, are in favor of. So it's really a great honor for me to introduce our speaker who is going to take us back a little bit to some of the roots of the radical movement that Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was in as a student leader in the 1979 era. So without further ado, I give you Mark Bowden, and please give him a nice wet welcome.
Well, thank you very much for coming. I appreciate it. I have to say, I'm going to talk for a few minutes about some of what I'm going to talk about are cultural differences, but before I launch into that conversation, I don't know if some of you saw the story on page one of the New York Times today from Iran, which underscores for me that no matter how hard you may work to understand someone else or another country or culture, that there remain, I think, there will remain some really basic, troubling differences. And the story I'm referring to is the Iranian High Court, which upheld, or rather overturned, murder convictions against several members of what's called the Basij, the people who I encountered, actually, when I was in Iran, They are basically civilian Islamist brown shirts. They enforce public morality. And in the case that is in the Times this morning, several of them beat to death a number of people who they thought exhibited public immorality. In one case, it was a couple who were engaged who were seen walking together in public, holding hands, and were stoned to death. I think the man was actually dragged into a pond and sat upon until he drowned. There was another instance where a local judge condemned a 16-year-old girl to death because of violations of what he described as violations of chastity, and immediately carried out the sentence, hung this girl. And he was convicted at a lower court of murder, but the higher court in Iran has overturned that conviction, essentially empowering these thugs to take the life of anyone who they deem to be immoral. And believe me, they define immorality in a very broad sense. So I am going to talk a little bit about how Iran and the United States see the world differently, but at heart, I don't think too many of us would agree with the sort of founding principles of the theocratic Islamic Republic. One of the hazards of writing true stories or writing nonfiction, as I do, is that you are often mistaken for an expert, which I'm generally not. For instance, when I wrote the book Black Hawk Down, which is, of course, about the Battle of Mogadishu in 1993, it was the first time that I'd ever written about the military, and I've never served in the military. I'm about as thoroughgoing a civilian as you'll ever meet, a newspaper reporter. Nevertheless, when I was touring around the country promoting the book Black Hawk Down, a lot of times at military bases, there was the assumption that I was steeped in military history, if not personal experience with the military. So, for instance, at the Army War College in Carlisle, I was talking about Black Hawk Down, and at the end, a colonel in the back of the room raised his hand and asked me if I thought that Bradley armored vehicles should have been part of the force protection package in Somalia. And I told him that I thought before anyone was entitled to have an opinion about a Bradley armored vehicle, that at least they ought to know what one looked like. And since I didn't qualify, I would defer. I get invited often enough to answer questions on television. These cable news shows that are like 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, are insatiable in their demand for so-called experts, and so I get called. And if I have a book or an article in The Atlantic or something that I'm trying to promote, I'll agree to go on. And it's a little bit dangerous because there's no telling what they're going to label you as. You know, the crawl at the bottom of the screen might call you a terrorism expert or Middle East expert, you know, none of which I certainly am. I did a show, I think it was Meet the Press, and you tape it in advance. So I was home when it aired, and my son, my youngest son, who then was 16, walked in the room. He sees his dad on television, so he sits down to watch the interview, and at the end of it, he looks at me and he says, "Dad, why are they asking you?" Which I thought was an excellent question, actually. I don't know if any of you have had the experiences, you know, that I've had. Some of you probably have, of traveling in essentially unfriendly parts of the world. By which I mean unfriendly to the United States or unfriendly to the West, and it is a real eye-opening experience. You know, for those of us who were, you know, born and raised in the United States or in the Western world, I mean, you may disagree with people about things, but you have a general shared context. And very often, you know, we're used to a situation where a disagreement can ultimately be resolved by resorting to a look at the facts. You know, sometimes disagreements stem from ignorance, and very often we can resolve our differences by looking at the truth of a thing. But what you discover when you're in a country like, you know, Iran or, you know, Pakistan or other places where you run into people who are just like from a different planet, is a level of disagreement that can't be resolved by an appeal to the facts. And it's because the people that you're dealing with have almost an alternate view of reality. It's a view of the world that has been pieced together layer by layer over many years and sometimes generations, so that they quite literally have a totally different frame of reference for the world than you have. And this results in situations where you can agree on the facts of an instance or a situation and completely disagree about what it means. And I think that was what happened in 1979, after the Iranian Revolution, when the United States the Carter administration decided to keep the United States Embassy functioning in downtown Tehran. This was a move that made great sense from the American point of view. We have obviously long-standing ties with Iran. Iran was a tremendously important country to us in that part of the world. And we had failed to foresee the revolution that swept the Shah aside, and obviously the character of this revolution was really a mystery at that point to the Western world, this Islamist revolution and the return of the Ayatollah Khomeini. Nevertheless, the Carter administration had decided that we were going to do our level best to accept the new regime in Iran, whatever it was, and continue to deal with them. And that decision was based upon a fairly cold-eyed analysis of the situation. Iran's military, for instance, was entirely trained and equipped by the United States. So they needed us. I mean, they needed us to keep their airplanes flying and to keep their armed forces well supplied with parts and training. And they needed us because they were in a dangerous part of the world. They were, they shared a border with the Soviet Union to the north. Saddam Hussein was constantly menacing them to the west. They were in a vulnerable position, and they absolutely needed, we thought, their relationship with the United States. So to the Carter administration, maintaining a busy, active embassy in the heart of Tehran, all through those sort of months of turmoil after the revolution, was the clearest statement that we could make as a country that we were still interested in Iran and that we were ready to deal with them in whatever shape their new government took. So to us, the embassy was a symbol of our acceptance of the revolution. Now here's how the Iranians saw it. In 1953, the United States had engineered the overthrow of their elected government in Iran, replacing Mohammad Mossadegh, the prime minister, with the Shah of Iran, who was essentially an American puppet for 25 years. And everyone in Iran, much more so than Americans remembered this, but everyone in Iran with any level of education remembered that the United States had propped up the Shah and had overthrown their government. Now here they had just held a remarkable revolution, and I think it's probably always been true of revolutions, but when you're successful in a revolution, no one is more astonished, I think, than you are. In fact, the Shah fell so rapidly and with such relative ease, it certainly shocked the United States of America. We never saw it coming. And Iranians themselves were really startled with their success in this revolution. So it was perfectly natural for them to assume that it wasn't over, because the Shah, after all, had been America's puppet in Iran. So they had succeeded in chasing the Shah out of their country, but there was this tremendous and legitimate, I think, fear, even expectation, that the United States was not going to let this happen. The United States was going to step in, pull the plug on their revolution, and reinstall the Shah, or reinstate some regime that was friendly to the United States. So, under those circumstances, what does a busy American embassy in the heart of their capital city look like? It looks like a plot that's being carried out right in their midst, and visually reinforced by the fact that the United States embassy in Tehran was had been overrun briefly in February. People were throwing rocks at it, taking shots at it. So they had built it up like a bunker. They had felt very high steel bars out along the brick walls in the front. They had lined all of the windows of the chancery building with sandbags and heavy layers of plastic. So here was this American bunker in the heart of their city with all these American diplomats, you know, coming and going at all hours of the day and night. And to the average Iranian, this looked like something that they had to put a stop to really quickly. Now, the architects of the takeover of the embassy were essentially students, for the most part, Islamist students, who feared the worst. And they definitely believed that the embassy was a symbol of their continued servitude to the United States and didn't feel that their revolution had a chance of being successful until they had closed it down and kicked out the spies. So you can see how the exact same set of circumstances, this embassy in the middle of Tehran, was seen in two completely different ways by the United States and by Iran. When I began working on this book, Guest of the Ayatollah, it was a departure for me in that it was the biggest story of more than a year. Those of us who remember this episode know that from November of 1979 until January of 1981, this was the dominant news story, certainly in the United States, if not the world. And so to just get my arms around all of the material that had been published about this and written about it was a monumental task. There were literally thousands and thousands of pages of newspaper coverage. There were 30 different books that had been written about it, but all of the books were about little slices of the story. Individual hostages who wrote about their experience in captivity, or members of the Carter administration who wrote about the futile efforts at resolving this through back-channel diplomacy. You even had one or two of the commanders of the ill-fated rescue mission who wrote about the rescue mission. But much to my surprise, no popular journalist or historian had written a book about the whole thing, had really tried to pull this whole story together. And it seemed to me, in light of what's happened in the last 6 years since the attacks on September 11th, that we all have awakened to the threat of militant Islam worldwide. And when we think back to our own experience with it, the seizure of the American embassy in Tehran in 1979 was our first encounter. It was certainly the first time that we ever heard ourselves referred to as the great Satan. And the whole wealth of insulting Islamist rhetoric that we've all come to know and love came in the door in November of 1979 with the takeover of the embassy. Now, for me, it was an enormous challenge because it was such a sprawling story. And you have to, in order to write a book like this or tell a story like this, I think you have to find a way of conceptualizing it, at least to yourself. And so I started conceptualizing this story as a three-layer cake. Essentially, there were three separate parts of this story, each of which would warrant, it seems to me, its own book-length treatment. One is the story of the Carter administration, which was effectively destroyed by this foreign policy problem. Carter had been, until November of 1979, going into the or ending the third year of his term of office, he was a very popular president. Believe it or not, we don't remember that about him, but the polls showed that he was enormously popular. And after the takeover of the embassy, his popularity actually went way up, as a president's popularity usually does in times of national crisis. But over the months and months and months of his powerlessness, of his inability to resolve this problem, you see his poll numbers just go down and down and down. And then, of course, came the failed rescue mission in April of 1980, after which his ratings just plummeted. So Carter, I know, had a lot of issues as president, as all presidents do, but I think it can be fairly argued that the takeover of the American embassy destroyed that presidency. Carter certainly thinks so and has written to that effect. So that's one layer of this story. The second layer, which is just truly fascinating, is the story of this failed rescue mission, which is truly one of the most extraordinary military missions ever undertaken by this country. And it ended so spectacularly that very few people, I think, who haven't really studied it, understood exactly what it was that this group was trying to do. And just very briefly, I'll describe to you, you know, what this mission entailed. It involved flying 130 Delta Force operators into Iran secretly aboard fixed-wing aircraft, and at the same time flying 6 to 8 helicopters secretly into Iran. Both the helicopters and the fixed-wing aircraft were to land at a desert airstrip on the outskirts of Tehran, at which point the helicopters would be refueled by big gas bladders inside the C-130s, and the Delta Force operators would then climb aboard the helicopters, which would fly to a hide site on the outskirts of the city, where the helicopters and the men would be hidden throughout an entire day. Then the men were going to get on trucks and drive into downtown Tehran, raid the embassy compound, rescue the hostages, blow a hole in the wall of the compound wall, lead all their hostages across the street to a soccer stadium, strong point to soccer stadium. I'm just getting started with this. Then the helicopters, which were hidden, were going to fly into the soccer stadium, load up all the hostages and the Delta Force guys, and while this was happening, a brigade of U.S. Army Rangers was going to assault and take an airstrip on the outskirts of Tehran. So then the helicopters were going to shuttle all of the hostages and the operators to the airstrip, where fixed-wing aircraft would be flown in, everybody would be loaded on the fixed-wing aircraft, and they'd fly them out of Iran. Simple, huh? It was, I think, I call it in the book, a sort of Rube Goldberg contraption of a mission. But it was the best that we could do. And a lot of people who look back at Jimmy Carter and his handling of this crisis, one of the first criticisms that you hear is that he should have done something right away, you know, when they took the embassy. Well, Carter actually had a nightmare on the first day, you know, that the embassy was taken. And his nightmare was that these American hostages would be taken out and executed one at a time. So he went to his military advisors and he said, "What can we do if we have to act right away, if we have to do something?" And the answer was really ridiculous. I mean, basically nothing. We do have the capability today of projecting a small force almost anywhere in the world very quickly, but we didn't in 1979. And Tehran was a fairly isolated capital city. We certainly couldn't have taken off from any of the Soviet states to the north. We had to basically fly out of one of the Arab states to the south or from aircraft carriers in the Persian Gulf, which meant a very long flight into Tehran, 500, 600 miles. We didn't have helicopters with folding rotors, which we needed to hide them on aircraft carriers, that could be refueled in the air. So we had to contrive a way to get the helicopters to the outskirts of Tehran and refuel them. And then hide them, you know, for the next day. It was virtually impossible. So actually, in the book, I talk about the deputy commander of Delta Force, which had just been formed, who was asked to brief the Joint Chiefs on what Delta could do the day after the embassy was taken, if they were ordered to go in and try and rescue the hostages. And here's his briefing in a nutshell. It actually began with him telling the Joint Chiefs, "Obviously, we don't want to do this." But what they had to offer was they would parachute in to the outskirts of Tehran and hijack trucks off of the road, basically just grab the drivers and throw them out and take their trucks, and drive the trucks into the city, attack the compound, load the hostages onto the trucks, and fight their way 500 miles to the Turkish border. It would have been suicide. But that's Carter's option, short of doing something that would have seriously escalated the situation into a confrontation potentially with the Soviet Union. And, you know, the great fear in the Cold War was always that there would be an issue in the Middle East that would ignite some kind of world conflict and an exchange of nuclear arms. So Carter had, I think, a very, very difficult situation to handle and didn't have a lot of tools to work with. The tool he was eventually given is this rescue mission, and I think that story alone is worthy of book-length treatment. And I was, in this book, for the first time, able to interview the members of Delta Force who went on that mission. So it's fascinating to read about this effort through the eyes of the men who undertook it. The last layer of this three-layer cake that is actually my favorite is the story of the hostages. There were 52 Americans who were held for 444 days, for a year and a month about, and we look back on their experience with hindsight, knowing that they ultimately all got home safely. And I think that colors our perception of their experience. In fact, they had no idea that they were ever going to get home safely. They were threatened from day one with being put on trial as spies and being executed. And this is in the context of a country that is marching people up in large numbers on rooftops and shooting them down and hanging them. We were in the middle of the sort of the phase of the revolution where the purges have begun. So on television every day in Tehran, you could see people being executed en masse. So the threat of trial and execution was not sort of an idle threat that you know, maybe in you know, the way we think of capital punishment in this country, if you're convicted, maybe 20 years later they carry out the sentence. This was an immediate and very frightening prospect for all of these Americans who were held. They were all accused of being spies. So in short, it was a terrifying experience. Those who were perceived as high-level or important spies, because they were all regarded as spies, were kept in isolation, were interrogated for months on end, were beaten, some of them, very badly treated. So this was just a terrifying ordeal. And I think, you know, my effort as a writer is always to try to get at, you know, the, what I call the dramatic center of a story, which is to find the people who were the most directly affected by the story I'm writing about and tell their stories. And so I spent a lot of time putting together the stories of all of these individual hostages. And what was remarkable about them is all the sort of tremendous variety of ways that people coped with this ordeal. Everyone is different. Everyone reacts differently to fear and pressure. And it really is, I think, a reflection of their personality, how they cope. Just a couple examples. One of my favorites was Catherine Kube, who was one of the two women who were held for the entire time. Catherine was running, prior to the revolution, the Iran-America Cultural Society, which was basically an organization that worked on cultural exchange between Iran and the United States. So she would arrange for Iranian dance troupes to come tour the United States, and she would bring American performers and artists to perform in Iran. She had a building and a staff, a fairly large staff of Iranians in downtown Tehran, and because of that fact, because she was had her own campus and had her own staff, she was perceived as a highly important spy. And so she was not allowed to return home when the Ayatollah released all of the women that they were holding. As a gesture, the Ayatollah released most of the women they were holding, except for the really important ones, and most of the African Americans that they had taken, because, of course, black people wouldn't have important jobs in an embassy. Interestingly, one of the African Americans that was released, Neil Robinson, was actually one of the more important spies in the embassy. He was a major in the Air Force working for defense intelligence, and today he's a brigadier general who runs the National Security Agency down Fort Meade. He's a... not Fort Meade, but it's right there off of Baltimore, Washington Parkway. At any rate, Catherine was a very religious woman, and the way that she coped with this ordeal was that she imagined herself to be on an enforced religious retreat, like a nun in a Carmelite convent. And she arranged, or she structured her days with prayer rituals in the morning and in the afternoon and evening, which she adhered to very closely. And this gave her a real sense of, as I said, structure, which I think is terribly important in this kind of situation. It also gave her the sense that she was accomplishing something, that she was growing spiritually. And she says to this day that in some ways, you know, that experience really shaped her as a person and deepened her faith and made her a more spiritual person. So I thought that was a very creative and interesting way of coping. Another completely different example is a young Army sergeant named Joe Subic. Joe's way of coping with the ordeal was to be as cooperative as he could possibly be to his captors. So, for instance, on the first day when all these American diplomats are tied to chairs and blindfolded, their captors, these Iranian students, who have no idea how an embassy works or the variety of functions in an embassy, they're trying to figure out who they are and who are the really, you know, important people. Most of the Americans there, you know, believed this whole thing could only last for a day or two, so they weren't being particularly helpful. So when they were asking people, for instance, you know, what's your name and what's your job, they would be getting answers like, well, you know, my name is Roy Rogers, and, you know, my job is I deliver pizza, you know, to this place. But Joe took his captors around and introduced all of his colleagues to them. This is Colonel Chuck Scott. He's the military liaison. By the way, he speaks fluent Farsi. Oh, this is Tom Ahern, is the CIA station chief here. You know, this is Ann Switch. She's the top political secretary at the embassy. So he was someone his colleagues would like to strangle from day one. Joe got special treatment for his helpfulness. He's the one who, for instance, when the Iranians held their propaganda Christmas pageant, Joe helped them set that up, and he made the Christmas card from the hostages to the Ayatollah Khomeini. He read propaganda statements on television, and when they came home safely at the end of the year, a lot of the military people in particular wanted Joe to be court-martialed, but in the general flood of good feeling toward the returned hostages, he was not prosecuted for anything that he did. The only thing that really happened to Joe was that when Ronald Reagan invited all the former hostages to the White House to be honored, he was not invited. And it was interesting that no one noticed. I looked back on all the news coverage, and no one picked up on the fact that there was this one hostage who was not invited to the White House. And the story of Joe's behavior and the way he handled all this is really told for the first time in Guests to the Ayatollah. My favorite, though, of all of the hostages is a fellow named Michael Matrinko, who was from Oliphant, Pennsylvania, not too far from here. Michael is the sort of person, maybe you've met people like this, who, when they go to a foreign country, they sort of blend. I mean, they're like chameleons. They learn languages very quickly. They adopt the diet, the routines, the clothing. You know, they just blend. And that's Matrinko. He had gone to Iran 6 years prior to this as a Peace Corps volunteer, and he had learned the language fluently, and he also had fallen in love with Persian culture, with poetry, with the food, with, you know, the history, the traditions of the country. And as a political officer in the embassy, he was having the most fun of his life. He felt that this, for someone who was basically a political scientist, was the most interesting place to be in the world. He likened it to being a geologist camped on the rim of an active volcano. And Michael's the kind of guy who, he's not the sort of person who likes to show up at work on time, but he would do most of his work in the evening. He loved to eat and smoke and drink, and he would go out with Iranians and stay up all night listening and asking questions, and he was writing reports back to the State Department trying to explain, you know, this tremendously chaotic world that Iran had become in the months after the revolution. So Michael was fully engaged in loving life and his work when suddenly he was tied to a chair and basically locked in a closet for the whole time that he was held in captivity. And he was pissed. He was one angry guy. And he was mad on not just because he had been taken captive, but like on the first day he had stuff planned that afternoon and evening that he was really looking forward to, you know? And who were these people to stop him? So Michael nursed that anger through the entire 444 days that he was held captive. He abused his captors in every way he could. He knew their language and their culture, so he was really good at insulting them and getting under their skin. He needled them and berated them and showed them how ignorant they were and insulted them. And for this, he was very frequently beaten. And as I said, he was held in solitary confinement virtually the entire time. When they held that Christmas pageant a month after the embassy was taken, of course, Michael was not invited to attend. But in the general sort of self-congratulatory mood of the day, the pious Islamist students who were holding him captive decided as a gesture to collect some of the goodies that they'd assembled from this party and bring it to him on a plate in the basement. So they brought him this plate full of goodies. Michael was hungry. He had not been fed well through, you know, the first month of captivity, so he was starving, and here was this this plate full of treats. And he debated with himself, he said, for about 10 seconds and banged on the door and said he had to go to the toilet. Michael called it the Khomeini hole. And they led him down the hall, and he carried his plate with him down the hall, and before all the guards dumped the contents into the toilet, which horrified them. He, you know, was obviously a very rude thing to do, you know, for their with their gift to him, but he was beaten for that. When I was in Iran, you know, one of the things that I asked the former captors, the Iranian students who are now middle-aged, if who they remembered among the American hostages, and they all remembered Matrenko, and they hated him. As Massimeh Ebtekar told me, he hated and was hated in return. And Michael kept this up until literally the last day when they loaded all the hostages on buses and took them to the airport to fly them home. Michael picked a fight with one of the guards on the bus with an insult that's too crude for me to repeat, and was dragged off the bus and beaten as the bus pulled away, at which point he said he had himself begun to doubt the wisdom of his approach to captivity. However, the agreement was that they would send all of the hostages home, so they threw Michael in a car, and they drove him to the airport, and a little bit scraped and bruised and bloody, they put him on the plane with everyone else. Now, no one's heard the story of Michael Matrenko before, because he, unlike many of his fellow hostages, did not become a kind of professional former hostage when he came home. He, in fact, when they flew to Wiesbaden, he had friends in Wiesbaden and was really looking forward to going out on the town, and he told them that he was going to leave. And they said, well, you can't leave. You know, we have psychologists, you know, ready to counsel you. We have, you know, dignitaries from the United States ready to meet with you. We have the press. You know, they all want to interview. And Michael said he asked them, am I a hostage? And they all said, oh, well, of course not. You know, so he left. And he went drinking down the Rhine and just went right back to work for the State Department. In fact, my latest communication with Michael is an email I got from him a few months ago, where he's living in a tent in Afghanistan, working as the liaison between the United States government and the parliament in Afghanistan. So this is, I think, a legitimate American hero, and one of the things I'm proudest of in this book is that for the first time, I managed to corner Michael on one of his infrequent trips back home and get him to tell me this whole story. It's such an impressive story that Bill Dougherty, who is one of the CIA officers who was also very badly treated during the time he spent in captivity, has said that for years, as he's talked about his experience, he's always made a point of saying that there were no heroes among the hostages. He said, having actually read your book, I now have to amend that and say there was actually this one guy who would have to be considered a hero, and that's Michael Matrenko. Clearly, a project like this is fascinating in all respects, but to me, probably the most fun and interesting piece of it was going to Iran to find the hostage takers. They were students, most of them in their earlier to mid-20s in 1979, which makes them roughly contemporaries of my own. They're middle-aged now. Some of them have become opponents of the regime. Abbas Abdi, for instance, who was one of the instigators of the takeover of the embassy, along with Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the current president, even though he denies it. Abdi is a newspaper editor who has written critically of the regime and is in jail, actually, right now, because he published a poll a few years ago showing that upwards of 70% of Iranians want renewed ties with the United States. That was enough to get his newspaper shut down and for him to have an indeterminate prison sentence. Some of the former hostage takers have risen to the highest levels of government. Ahmadinejad, as I said, denies his involvement with the takeover of the embassy, but he was, in fact, one of the five Iranian students who planned and led the takeover of the American embassy. Another one of the core group was a fellow named Mohammed Hashemi. And I had a list of people who I wanted to interview when I went to Iran. He was on that list, but I assumed he would be the least likely person to agree to be interviewed because over the years he had become the second-ranking intelligence official in Iran. He was the deputy of their information ministry. So he was a top spy, and I assumed, even though I would make the request, that he would be the last person to agree to be interviewed. And much to my surprise, Mohammed immediately consented to be interviewed. So I went to see him. He had recently retired, and he's a sort of short, chubby guy with a long, bushy, graying hair and a beard, and he was terrific. He told me all about his motivations in taking over the embassy. He remembered Matrinko. He practically spat his name out and gave me his whole perspective on things. And at the end of our conversation, he says, "Now I'd like to talk to you about something." And it turns out that Mohammed, in his retirement, was planning a resort on the Caspian Sea and was looking to attract tourists to it. So he had brochures printed up in English and French and German. So he had big ambitions for this resort, and he was hoping to bend my ear about it and get some publicity. I, of course, was not the least bit interested in his resort project, but I was polite, and I listened. He had a big model of it, about as big as one of these tables, and he was just, getting practically rhapsodic about what a wonderful place this is going to be. When it occurred to him, he's speaking to me through a translator, he gets this great idea. He says, "We could even invite the hostages back to stay as our guests at the new resort." And so I listened to this. This is true. I'm not making it up. We actually have this on tape. And so I asked the interpreter, I said, "Ask him if this time they'll be allowed to go home when they want to." And there was this sort of glum look that came over his face and a delay. And then he says, "Oh, you make a joke," he says to me. I have to say I was tremendously relieved that he saw the humor in it. One last little story, and then I'll answer any questions if you have them. We have a few minutes left. We made a documentary film, a companion documentary to this book that has aired on the Discovery Channel. And so when I was in Iran the second time, they sent a still photographer over to take some publicity photos of me. So all afternoon, this guy's posing me at various places around Tehran. And he had me pose in front of a wall-sized mural of the Ayatollah Khomeini. Beaming beneficently down over my shoulder on this busy sidewalk. And he's taking my picture. An Iranian going by behind me says in perfect English, "What do you want a picture of that asshole for?" And I don't think he was talking about me. Thank you very much.
Hi, I'm Marilyn Stern. We're going to be doing the Q&A. Amy, we have till 1:30. Is that correct?
Yeah.
First, I'd like to ask, much of America's policies have been called unintended consequences, the Mujahideen yielding to the Taliban. As a journalist nowadays, what do you see as some of the unintended consequences of what's going on now? Just pick any of the topics. I'm sure you have many you could choose from.
Well, obviously, the thing about unintended consequences is that they're very terribly hard to foresee. I gave a talk at CIA headquarters not too long ago, and I told them, that we all hear the term intelligence failures a lot. And it seems to me that intelligence failures are inevitable. I know that my life is studded with intelligence failures. But any time, basically, we fail to foresee the future, in retrospect, in hindsight, we are accused of intelligence failures. But certainly, I think we've paid a big price and will continue to pay a big price for the aggressive military posture that our country has taken in the last 5 or 6 years. I think, as an American, it's perfectly understandable to me why we've projected force and power as aggressively as we have and why the rhetoric from Washington has been as belligerent as it's been. But I think, we are paying and will pay a big price for that down the road in terms of international perception. There's a very good documentary on television tonight, which I just reviewed today for the New York Times, about Indonesia, where there's a tremendous struggle going on in what is the largest Muslim country in the world between these extremist factions and the mainstream moderate Muslims in that country. And the anti-Americanism that has sprung up as a result of our invasion of Iraq in particular has fueled this extremist movement, is making big problems for moderates in that country. So You know, I do think that we need to be aware of that, and I think that probably we would be best advised as a country to let the pendulum swing in the other direction, if only for practical reasons, in the next presidential term or in the next 5 to 10 years, certainly.
Questions? Yes.
You indicated that right after the takeover there were no real decent military options available for President Carter. And I'm wondering if by that you mean that there was no way of rescuing the hostages, or was there no way of inflicting, of making a credible threat or following up with the threat, for example, capturing Carter Island or doing things that would have changed the dynamic, that it wasn't, the priority wasn't saving the hostages, but making sure that something like this didn't happen again.
Yeah. Well, very clearly, the United States had other military options, all of which would have dramatically escalated the situation. First of all, if you're concerned about hostages, you want to avoid having them be executed. And so, any sort of aggressive action you're taking obviously places their life at greater risk. So that was heavily on Carter's mind. But you also have to think, other than the fact that this was an enormous media event, which preoccupied our press and the world press for more than a year, how significant was it, that 52 Americans were being held hostage in Tehran? It was certainly a crime against the international community and a crime against diplomacy, and it was a tremendous provocation and insult to the United States. But our national security was not threatened in any way by Iran or the fact that they were holding these Americans there. And so I think Carter, especially in the context of the Cold War, was prudently trying to avoid making this problem into something a lot worse than it needed to be. And so, ultimately, those hostages all were returned home safely. The Soviets took advantage of the situation to invade Afghanistan. Saddam Hussein invaded Iran in 1980. So, Carter's take on this was the only people who are in real terms going to be hurt by this episode in the long run is Iran. And I think he was right about that. So other than the fact that, we were demonstrated to be vulnerable to this kind of high-profile stunt, our country was not terribly threatened by what happened there. So I think that was why he didn't take more aggressive military steps.
Bob.
You were aware, of course, of the Iran nuclearization, and the thought that many think that once Iran becomes nuclear, it becomes a world threat, including to American security, especially with Sahab missiles that can reach even the United States in about 5 years. Some say diplomacy, sanctions. If all that fails, there's the military option.
Mm-hmm.
And you must have been reading what I read, where it's laid out.
Right.
Now, if you say the war in Iraq has caused international reaction, what would a military attack on Iran do, and what's the alternative?
Well, clearly there's a huge downside to any military attack on Iran. It would do more than anything we've done since Iraq to portray the United States as an enemy of Islam and as a crusading Christian nation, which is, I think, the way we would be portrayed in the world. It would have a tremendous downside in Iran, where, in fact, the regime in power is extremely unpopular. And most people, as I can testify from personal experience, many average Iranians despise this regime and want to change it and want better ties with the Western world. I think that would go out the window if we attacked Iran. Iranians are, they may despise their regime, but they're a tremendously proud and nationalistic people. And I think most Iranians, even those who are opposed to the regime, would perceive an attack by the United States as an attack on their country, on their nationhood, and they would, we would gain more support for the Ayatollahs. That would probably make them the most popular figure they've been in the last 25 years. And then worldwide, it would ignite, I think, you know, Islamist outrage throughout the world. So the only justification, it seems to me, to launch a military attack on Iran would be if it posed an immediate threat to this country and if all the alternatives had been exhausted. And I think even the Bush administration, which has been extremely aggressive in these matters, sees the logic of that. And I think that the way that we're proceeding is actually the right way to go with Iran. I do think that to the extent that we work through the international community and can get them to apply significant pressure on Iran, that seems to me to have a strong chance of succeeding. Because I think it isolates the mullahs. It makes them appear to be taking positions that are damaging to Iran, that people can actually feel in their lives. I think it weakens the regime, and so that's the alternative, it seems to me. Clearly, Israel has another take on this. I mean, it's a very small nation. You know, one nuclear missile could just about destroy Israel. I don't think that's a country that can wait to see whether Ahmadinejad means what he says. So it's a very, very dangerous situation right now, and, you know, I'm hopeful, but it could be the kind of thing that could lead to a very devastating war.
Mark, I don't know if you had a chance or an opportunity to interview the British sailors and Marines that were taken hostage. Would you just compare and contrast that hostage statement just recently with the one that you wrote about in the book?
No, I, of course, haven't talked to the British sailors. And I remember my publisher had said that he was grateful to Ahmadinejad because he's doing a lot to help sell my book, you know, reminding people that Iran takes hostages. Clearly, the way I look at this episode is it was, to an extent that wasn't true 25 years ago, this was a deliberate provocation by the Iranian government, particularly by the Revolutionary Guards and Ahmadinejad. And I think that initially Great Britain, Tony Blair in particular, played right into their hands by making very threatening comments, threatening to escalate this into something more. Essentially, I don't think there's not a reasonable person in the world who could have accused Great Britain of attempting an invasion of Iran with 15 sailors in a rubber boat. So what they were guilty of, if anything, was transgressing an invisible line in the water, which is much in dispute anyway. So I think ultimately cooler heads prevailed on both sides, which was the case also 25 years ago, only much, you know, more quickly here. And both that Great Britain realized that it made a lot more sense just to treat this as a minor dispute over a barrier in the water than as a, you know, potential, you know, international episode. And I think that had the effect of taking away whatever advantage Ahmadinejad was getting out of this episode. So I think he regrouped quickly. They did it because they thrive on confrontation with the West. And, you know, I think it shored up Ahmadinejad's support among radical militant factions within his own country. And he was shown in the end, I think, a very clever manipulation of this episode at the end, you know, in his magnanimous gift to the British people, you know, releasing these sailors who we had no right to take in the first place, you know, was a piece of public theater, very much like the takeover of the embassy in 1979 was a piece of public theater, and I think he orchestrated it, at least in his own country, to his own advantage.
Question at the end there?
Yeah. I very much enjoyed your talk, but it seems to me that there has been a thrust of appeasement in some of the arguments that you make here. Yes, we could accommodate these people in some way. We shouldn't be as insistent on the military threat. But what about the fact that there really is a threat there? And I also was struck by the fact that you seem to accept the argument given by the Iranian nationalists, the Islamists, that the Shah really was an American puppet. You use that term. Mm-hmm. I'm not certain that that was so. Yes, we did put him back in power, and there was a overthrow of some kind of popular rebellion that had installed Mossadegh. But the fact is, he was an independent entity, and my understanding is that much of the opposition to him emerged
because he was modernizing his country, because he was breaking the mold of the Ayatollahs and the Mullahs in his country.
Well, first of all, I do think that the Shah was an American puppet. I think that he was very definitely put in power by a CIA-engineered coup d'etat, that American money and support is what enabled him to hang on to power over years in which he became increasingly unpopular. So without any doubt, in my mind, the Shah was basically in power because the United States and Great Britain wanted him there and stayed in power for that reason. So in that sense, you know, the overthrow of the Shah was an effort to throw off the ties with the connections with the United States, and it made perfect sense for them to, you know, completely sever those ties. The Shah did anger, one of the things that fueled the revolution was his modernization campaigns, things which we Americans would applaud and agree with. But I think we make the mistake, because we don't study history closely enough, of assuming that the revolution in Iran was primarily Islamist to begin with, and it was not. The revolution that took place in February of 1979 was a coalition of forces in Iran, which included communists, socialists, included Iranians who wanted a democratic state, and it also included a huge element of radical Islamist followers of the Ayatollah Khomeini, who provided, I think, the, you know, the hundreds of thousands of people who came out into the streets. Nevertheless, the intellectual core of that revolution was not primarily Islamist in character. And what you saw there is what often happens in a revolution. You get a number of forces who are would ordinarily be disagreeing with one another, but they come together united by their hatred of the leader, in this case, the Shah. And so what was happening after that revolution was, in the months that the embassy was taken, there was a real power struggle going on inside of Iran over what the nature of that new regime was going to be. And it's quite possible, and one of the reasons that we kept our embassy in Tehran and wanted to keep ties with that country, it was possible that things were going to work out to you would have a, basically a friendly, secular, even possibly democratic government formed in Iran. And that actually, one of the things that really startled me about this story when I began to research it was that probably the most significant political outcome of the takeover of the American embassy is it is the episode that leveraged the mullahs into power. It is more even than the overthrow of the Shah, the episode that gave the mullahs power in Iran, because they used their position when they took over the embassy, the Islamists did, to chase their rivals out of power, and I can tell you exactly how they did it. You remember that Joe McCarthy waving sheets of paper in front of television sets saying, you know, I have in my hand a list of 20, you know, communist spies in the State Department. And that was enough, those names on that sheet of paper, to destroy the careers of whoever's name was on it. Well, that exact same thing was going on in Tehran. The Iranian students, the Islamist students, seized the American files at the embassy. And it was enough for a prominent Iranian politician to have his name on the Rolodex of the chief political officer at the American embassy, where you would expect to find it in a, you know, a rational world. But it was enough to wave that in front of the cameras in Tehran and say, you know, this official was secretly meeting with these American spies. And it not only destroyed the careers of their political enemies, it sent many of them to prison and to their deaths. To this day, Abul Hassan Bani Sadr, who was elected president of Iran in January of 1980, 2 months after the takeover of the embassy, he won an election, and he was opposed to holding the hostages. He's been living in exile in Paris for the last 25 years because he is perceived to have been an American spy and a lackey of the Americans. Sadegh Gotsbadeh, who was the foreign minister who carried on secret negotiations with the United States, was executed in part because of that. So it was not as simple a thing as that. To my mind, it was clearly a revolution that overthrew an American puppet. I think we had legitimate reasons from our perspective for doing what we did in Iran, but we paid a heavy price for it down the road. And as far as appeasement goes, I think that I am in favor of doing everything we can to avoid going to war if war is going to have an enormous cost to our country and to our way of life, I don't think we would lose that conflict. But to me, it makes a lot of sense to avoid it if at all possible. And so I do think that we can't ignore what's going on in Iran. Most experts that I read don't believe that Iran has the capability presently to launch a nuclear weapon. It's out there in the not-too-distant future. I think we're working very hard and going about it in a smart way to try and avoid that situation, try and put smart pressure on Iran that can result in what we want. And clearly what we don't want is another all-out war in the Middle East against Iran and having to deal then with the fallout, you know, from Islamists throughout the world. So I'm an appeaser in the sense that I would rather not have that war if we can avoid it.
Now 1:30. It's going to bring the end of the lecture. If you want to stay afterwards and ask questions, you may. I want to thank Mr. Bowden.
Thank you. My pleasure.